Blog Talk Radio.
Did you start something? Hello. Yes, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio, K Thompson Live. This is Eric Payne here, and then here you're the host, K Thompson.
I know we are on. Good evening, everyone. K Thompson Live. We're going to be, we have a couple of good topics for you. And something that I've been very concerned with for a long period of time. By the way, I want to announce that Wayne Gilman will be calling in. Wayne Gilman, who is Jones, former news director of WLIBBLS, the station in New York that really catapulted the black community into a national station. And he's going to be calling in. And we are also going to be talking to Richard Wesley, who is a writer, and he has been in a number of films, and I'm quite sure that you will want to hear what he is going to be talking about. But before we do that, you know, there are a couple of news items, hot topics that I want to mention today before we even get into things. And the first one I want to talk about is, where are my notes? As a matter of fact, the racial incarceration. You know, I've been concerned about this, but ever since, you know, I was over at WLIB on the air about the racial disparity rates in New Jersey prisons, and it's the highest in the United States. For those of you who really don't know about the jails and the amount of people in jails and the amount of people in incarceration, which is the majority of the people in jails are black and Latino. And New Jersey has the biggest gap between black and white incarceration rates of any state in the United States, according to a report that was released Tuesday by a nonprofit organization that advocates for change. And now, according to a study released by the Washington, D.C.-based Sentencing Project, New Jersey puts black residents behind bars 12 times the rate of white residents. Although it noted that a gap is expected to shrink because of recent changes to the state sentencing laws. Now, that's going to be very interesting. I have not heard of any work even being done on lifting the sentencing and the sentencing rates for African Americans, because it is unfair, and a lot of people are very much aware that it is unfair, and it has happened all around the country. As a matter of fact, there's so many different, organizations dealing with the incarceration of black Americans that you can even think of. So the gap is expected to change because of the recent changes. Hopefully, nationally, that disparity is closer to 5-1, the report found. Now, let's see, the sentencing project in New Jersey puts black residents behind bars 12 times the rate of white residents. Although it noted that gap is expected to shrink because of recent changes to the state's sentencing laws. And I just read that. So, now, in recent years, New Jersey has been held as a national leader in reducing its prison population, although I don't find that to be really factual. That was a fact highlighted by President Barack Obama, who last fall, visited Newark to push his criminal justice reform agenda, and New Jersey's racial disparity in prison population is expected to fall. Okay, I probably came across that information somewhere along the line. And then also the sentencing project, the lady's name is Ashley Nellis, and she's a senior researcher at the Sentencing Project, who wrote the report, said in an interview, "The effect of state-level reform on African-American incarceration is probably going to take a little longer because the disparity is so severe." New Jersey was one of the five states, along with Iowa, Minnesota, Vermont, Wisconsin, where the black-to-white disparity was more than 10 to 1. And the figures are based on state incarceration rate per 100,000 residents. Really interesting. African Americans make up less than, I'm getting this information by the Star, from the Star Election, by the way. So African Americans make up less than 15% of New Jersey's population, but more than 60% of the state's prison population. As a state's prison population. In 2014, there are 25,590 prisoners in New Jersey, 13,170 of whom were black, 4,750 of whom were white, and 3,454 of whom were Hispanic, according to the Sentencing Project data. The report attributed the racial disparity in incarceration rates to three factors. Policies and practices such as drug-free zone, school zones, laws that disproportionately affect African racial Americans. Then it goes on. So I want to really, you know, keep up with this because of the fact that when I was over at WLIB, the jail populations were absolutely bulging with African Americans, and more blacks and Latinos were jailed than were whites. And very often in the same, you know, level of crime. Eric, do you find that? Do you know anything about this?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Anyway, and there's another thing that I'm really very interested in, and I'm quite sure a lot of other people, while we're waiting to hear from Wayne Gilman, he's going to be calling in, and he can confirm a lot of this information. Tempers flare and lawmakers debate gun control bills. Now, what's happening is that people really were concerned over the massacre in Orlando, Florida. Now, the tempers flared Tuesday as divided state California lawmakers advanced a dozen gun control bills, including proposals to outlaw the sale in California of semi-automatic rifles with easily detachable magazines. What the heck is going on? We have all these kind of guns that are, you know, that what are guns? Guns are made to kill people. So now we have guns that are automatic, and they're being sold without even adequate, you know, justification for having these semi-automatic rifles. The bills originally that were introduced in response to a mass shooting in San Bernardino, you remember that, in December, but the killing of 49 people in an Orlando nightclub Sunday was invoked over and over Tuesday by Democrats as state legislative committees heard testimony before voting to send bills to the floor for votes. Wow. Okay. We're going to be going now to Wayne Gilman. Hello, Wayne. How are you there?
Hi, Kay. Can you hear me?
Yes, look, I can hear you now. We had a little bit of trouble.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize. I would have been there, but I'll explain later. Something came up with me, and I had to address it right away. And to be continued, you know, we'll get out there and meet and all that. But, yeah, this situation with the violence is just way out of hand. It amazes me that we've become somewhat numb by this situation. That you know, it happens. We're sorry to hear it happens, and then life continues. And I think it's commendable that a lot of the late night talk show hosts have taken the time out of their shows to address the issue, because you know, this is not something that we could just sit back and just take it like as if it's the new normal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the one thing that I find so disconcerting. We know, at least I feel, that one of the presidential candidates has been stirring the pot. Question about that, and the level of vitriol has gotten to the point where, you know, so many people are upset about what is going on, and to play on the fears of those Americans who are not as informed as those who are, I just think is so disingenuous and sinful. And I'm so glad that the president came out yesterday and spoke about it to address the issue. And still, you know, the game plan continues. And this is one of the worst political elections I've ever witnessed, where there's just a blatant lack of respect.
Yeah, I understand. We have another caller calling in. This may be Richard Wesley. I'm going to be seeing if he's on the line. Richard Wesley, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi Richard. How are you?
Okay.
You know, we're
I'm doing
about...
fine. Can't complain. And I called in. I sort of heard the last part of the other caller's statement, and I agree completely.
Yeah.
This is one of the ugliest political seasons that I can ever recall. I would have thought 2012 was tough enough, but this one is really it's very difficult to stomach.
Yeah, it is. There's no doubt about it, and it's difficult because of the fact that we're right in the middle of it. And you know, if we don't cover these things dealing with this with these politicians, but we have to. The point is, we have got to let people know what's going on, especially with Trump, who is really, really he is crazy. That's the only thing I can tell about him, because of that stuff. You know, he's stirring up so much stuff that, I don't know, you don't feel safe in the country anymore, really, you know? So we're going to be getting to that later, but that's not why, we're talking to you. You are one of the main people in the Newark Film Festival, and so, find out about that. That's something pleasant. Karen, do you know about the film festival?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're beginning our new season, our 39th, on June the 29th, in fact. We're opening up with a documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone. It's a documentary about Nina Simone. And it covers... the years, roughly the years from the late 1950s when she first emerged in the public eye through to her untimely passing. There is some background information on her growing up years in North Carolina and everything, but the bulk of the presentation will cover those years. There's a lot of archival footage, both domestic and international, and some very interesting peeks at her rehearsal process, how she pulled songs together, worked in the studios with her fellow musicians, and everything like that. So it's a comprehensive look at Nina Simone during those years when she was very much in the public eye.
Yeah.
And also a look behind the scenes after she left the public eye as well. So.
Yeah. You know what? I think her last performance was done. I'm not sure of this. At Symphony Hall in Newark, and I was there. Yep, and that was when she ended up with Mississippi Goddam, okay?
Oh,
and she was absolutely incredible. That was the first time that I had heard of her, and I think that was her last performance there. And but the documentary I sat through is long, but so much information came out of there. And she was going through so much pain, because of she felt the way she looked, and she wasn't accepted in a lot of places, and what a talent. And said, well, you're going to be playing that entire, showing that entire documentary during the film festival?
Yes. This one, What Happened, Miss Simone, it runs roughly 2 hours and a little longer than 2 hours. I know that there have been other programs that, cover, I think, you would have to have multiple sittings to go through them. But this isn't one of those. So this one is really the a kind of it's comprehensive in its own right, and it runs roughly 2 hours. There's going to be several guest speakers. I'll be co-hosting with Gloria Hopkins Buck, who is a long-standing member. She's a founding member of the Newark Black Film Festival, and she's also on the board of directors of the museum itself. So, we're going to have a lively lineup, and I think there's going to be a pretty lively discussion as well, because there'll be a lot of people who will be attending who, like yourself, saw Nina Simone performing in person in Newark. And she was very close to the Baraka family. And even when she wasn't performing, there were times where she stayed in Newark, and she stayed at the home of Amiri and Amina Baraka. So she was someone who was very familiar with the city, and had been coming here off and on, I'd say, a good 30 years. There should be a lot of, discussion about that, and, of course, about her music and her career, her decision to leave the United States and take up residence in France, where she passed away. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a pretty exciting opening presentation by the film festival, and we'll be running all the way through every Wednesday night through the month of July, with our last presentation on August the 3rd, which will be the Paul Robeson Awards, a short film award presentation. And we'll be screening all those films at the Cineplex up there on Morris Avenue in Springfield Avenue in Newark, up in the Central Ward.
Uh huh.
And so,
Eric, you want to get in on this?
I didn't really get a chance to see the film. I think it was the subject of an HBO segment recently, some months ago. But I know, and the last time I think you were on,
mm-hmm.
Kay, we had talked about this. I later found out that Nina Simone's family is represented by someone that we had as an intern at the time. They're attorneys now, the Crow sisters. And they apparently have had some issues about some of the families had some issues about the presentation of the film. I don't know if there's any discussion with respect to that or expect.
No, we haven't had any comments or anything from the family. I think Nina Simone's daughter is featured in the film.
Right, but her brother is being represented by these young ladies that we had Kay and I had as interns,
mm-hmm.
at the station years ago, and he has gone public. I mean, he was on Entertainment Tonight one night commenting about the fact that there was not everything that was projected was authentic based on what he was saying. And,
I think my only comment to that would be, whenever you do a biopic like this, any kind of biography, the surviving family members are always going to be divided about the presentation. No matter who it is, there's always going to be someone in the family who's going to say, that's not presentation makes it look as though this happened and this happened and this happened when that wasn't the case. And then there's another group in the family that's going to say, the total opposite and everything. And, I'm not surprised. I think the same thing happened some years ago when, you know, there was a film about James Baldwin. And there's James, you know, Jimmy Baldwin's brother is right there in the film. But Jimmy Baldwin had more than one brother. And so some of the other siblings were saying, what he said isn't what happened and everything. And, you know, you know, it can get thick.
Yeah.
It can get thick.
What do you, Richard, what do you think? You heard about this, not a documentary about Nina Simone, but there's a feature film.
Oh, the feature film.
A lot of the people had issue with the fact that they darkened her skin, you know, to make her a la Forrest Whitaker in The Last King of Scotland. You know, they made her skin darker. Display that, and as I was looking on the social media sites that had trailers for this movie, a lot of people took issue with that, you know. And people
will continue to take issue with it. You know, it was. I do not, you know. I think, you know, she's a great actress. She's a very, very fine actress, but. This is a situation where she walked into the middle of a controversy and it was absolutely unnecessary. And, you know, a lot of people, she's not the only one, but there are a lot of people who were involved in that film who should have known better. And the fact that they didn't speaks volumes about how much education and sensitivity and insight still has to be arrived at by any number of people in this society. For a decision like that to have been made, you know, it's just unconscionable to me. I don't understand. And it wound up, you know, it wound up literally destroying that entire project because of that one decision. Millions of people across the country and probably around the world didn't even bother to go to see the film. Because, you know, you're not watching a story about Nina Simone. You're watching Teresa Saldana up there on screen, and you're going like, well, that's that Saldana chick there. That's Tender Uhura. And she got blackface on. You're paying attention to the actress and the makeup, and you're not paying attention to the story. So they undercut, you know, their own project.
Yeah. I thought the same thing with The Last King of Scotland, and I thought it was kind of surprising that Forrest went along with darkening his skin. It's kind of like, you know, what the white actors used to do when they would play Asians and they play black people. You know, it's a little bit borders on buffoonery to me. And it's surprising, surprising that people, you know, that I mean, if you have a lot of Caucasian people that might not know any better, but that might think that there's nothing wrong.
But you would
with
think
that.
That a black actor in the 20th century would understand that.
Exactly.
Certainly
would say that this looks ridiculous as it did. I mean, she didn't look as bad as Forrest, but. You know, it was ridiculous that she felt the need to have to do that and not to have the will to say that. So, that's probably why that film came and went. You know, we just had the Orlando shooting, and, you know, I know that you're aware in a lot of public issues and stuff like that. And you touched a little bit on Donald Trump's lunacy over the comments, you know, traditionally, you know, when issues like this happen, you know, you have the presidential candidates or people kind of take a moment of, they take a time out from the candidate, from the battling. But this guy, who was really despicable, no class, chose not to. And also to kind of stroke his own ego, you know, where he said, I predicted it. And, you know, we didn't mention at the top of the show that this Orlando shooting happened. Everybody knows it by now, but obviously our hearts go out to the people that had to suffer that, and it appears that the individual might have been a terrorist, or he might have just been conflicted within himself because he might have been gay, and because a lot of the a lot of the guys say that he was on a gay website, a gay dating website. And so it seems that in his struggle to walk the walk of his religion, he seems that he was conflicted. I just want to know all your guys' thoughts about that.
Well, it's another example. This whole thing is another example of why you don't run off at the mouth as soon as a microphone is put in front of you. You know, for all of the criticism and vitriol that is hurled at him, President Obama has been, I think, you know, one of the most level-headed and clear presidents we've had in a long time. You know, he didn't, like, get out and immediately start shaking his fists and threatening to launch every B-52 in the Air Force arsenal, send it over to the Middle East, and to be sure who this person was, and who this person was supposed to be representing or trying to represent before he would say anything. Unlike a certain other candidate for his office who went, you know, frothing at the mouth immediately. No, we don't know this person's, complete history. We're finding out things now some 72 hours or more after the incident itself, more and more about him. You know, you're learning things from, from his ex-wife, his current wife. You're learning things from interviews with his father, who every time he opens his mouth reveals more about him and the way he treated that young man when he was growing up than anything else.
Thank you.
And there is a lot here, trying to tie this to some sort of act of international terrorism, maybe literally jumping the gun. It may be that this guy is a domestic terrorist who reacted in a way out of a whole lot of personal things that were going on inside of him. And in his rage and in his anger and in his, completely unstable state of mind, he said everything that he could think of that would be hurtful and fear-mongering that he could. And what better, ISIS, Sharia law, whatever else he said. I mean, as he was shooting the place up, killing black people, he was saying, "I ain't got nothing against black people," but he was going to kill them anyway because they were in that bar, a bar that he had frequented. Now we're starting to learn a number of different times.
Mm-hmm. I actually heard that he let some black people go leave. Actually, he said, "I have no problem with the blacks." And
I don't know that he let them go free because that young girl who was being interviewed yesterday, she got shot in the leg.
Well, she was laying down, but I saw an interview with a couple of different people that said that he said that.
Maybe he did.
I have no problem with blacks, but I mean, regardless, I mean, it's still a horrendous
thing. It's a horrendous act, and him even bringing that up, like, why?
Right. Yeah. Why?
You're killing people.
You know, your point with the president responding the way he responded. It's the sensitivity of someone of color. The reason I believe why Barack Obama didn't respond as a Caucasian president probably would have, depending on the party, of course. And I think it's the sensitivity of people of color to understand that you don't just. There's a certain sensitivity that he's not going to just carpet, even though he has done a lot of predator and drone strikes. That's what they get him on. But there's a certain sensitivity just to not, like Ted Cruz, carpet bomb just the whole Middle East, which is tendency would have been the tendency, certainly, of someone like Donald Trump, and I'm sure other Republican presidents, maybe a few Democrat Caucasian presidents. So, you know, you have an idiot like the orange guy there who wants to just incite hate. I mean, you know, it's remarkable that the Republican Party and, you know, he's trying to insinuate that the president might be somehow complicit or might be sympathizing to this. It's just a lunacy. But what's even more, what's crazier, is that when asked the Speaker of the House and Mitch McConnell, the head of the Senate, if they felt that was inappropriate by reporters, both of them declined to comment on the issues of the presidential campaign, conveniently. And we know that yesterday, after the moment of silence, you know, Congressman Clyburn tried to get a point of information. And also when he was overruled and said that he was out of order, when they started yelling, "Where's the bill?" You know, I mean, the one Connecticut senator eloquently said that this moment of silence does nothing. It just makes you complicit without any action. And this Connecticut congressman walked off the floor. He wouldn't take part in this moment of silence, which is just lip service, you know. And, you know, I'm interested to see what you, Wayne, and Mom, and guys further think about that.
Well, it's, you know,
yes.
I just think that, you know, this entire political climate, you know, it's rife with, there's a level of, it's hard. I think the one period in the country that parallels this are the years just before the Civil War. And the reason why I make that comparison is I believe that what we're really seeing is an ideology, a political position, a supposed way of life that feels itself completely under threat. And if the demographics of the country hold up, that way of life is going to pass into history. And they are not happy about it. And
wow.
They're fighting
yeah.
tooth and nail to prevent it. And so at that, you know, when you're in that frame of mind, you will say anything. You will say everything, you know, that you feel. You know, and if need be, what we're seeing are a group of people who, on one level or another, are prepared to bring the entire country down.
Right.
Rather than see this new future come to pass.
I happen to concur, if you don't mind. You know.
No, not at all.
You know, we had talked about this at the very inception as the show started. And, again, I have to concur 1,000%. I was talking to Kay earlier today about someone I'm doing business with, and an older person, a flag-waving Republican. I mean, he's legitimate and not biased when it's dealing with the business that I conduct with him. He's my accountant. You know, just so there's an understanding of what's going on. But, you know, we have periodically a report on a friendly banter on the basis that, you know, he's very pro-Trump, and he points out why, and he cites all these things that are going on in Europe. He's well-traveled and things like that. And he hit a nerve with me this past weekend to the point where I was ready to abandon his practice after the Orlando thing because, you know, he's with shutting the borders down, Muslims being needing to be thoroughly interrogated over what their political beliefs are. And I'm trying to explain to him point by point, counterpoint, and all that. you know, what goes on. And it's a frustration that I find. I don't want to paint with a broad stroke. But whenever I come around white folk and we have this discussion, there's some people who are progressive and understand the changes that are going on. You know, when the Jews left Europe 60, 70 years ago, even more, to flee persecution, the Holocaust, all these things that were going on, you know, black folk and Native Americans didn't stand in righteous indignation, you know, saying, well, all right, you can't come here, you know, that sort of thing. Yesterday was a discussion with someone else. Another white professional I had here in White Plains, not going to call his name. He talks about his Second Amendment rights and why we need to have an AK-47. And I'm just saying, you have the Westchester County Police here. If, God forbid, something happened to you and they had to come to your home, what are you going to come out with, an AK-47? I mean, use your common sense. What's the purpose of all this nonsense? You know, the real elephant in the room are the guns, and no one is looking at that. Bloomberg, as much as I didn't, you know, approve of his administration, he had been talking about this up until the time he left office. All of a sudden, it died, you know? And again, as I said at the outset, I'm sick and tired of people being numb whenever an incident. This could have been you, Eric, me, my sister, Kay, your sister, in that club that night having a good time and, you know, indiscriminately or unfortunately just being caught up at the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm tired of it. I agree with the Connecticut senator who's conducted a filibuster today, talking about the issues, because it has to be talked about. You know, this can't be the new normal.
But if you think that, you know, if you convince yourself that your way of life, all the things that you believe are essential to your getting from Monday to Tuesday in one piece are now under threat because of government policies that are encouraging, you know, mass immigration or trade policies that are threatening the quote-unquote American way of life, then the next leap from that is, for some people, a radical defense of the home. You know, the country is under siege. The government is complicit. And
this is what I'm hearing.
And
this is how these people are talking.
I need a weapon to protect myself, because the very next thing that will happen is, you know, there'll be someone who takes over and they'll be trying to establish a dictatorship.
Yep.
So a well-armed militia is the protection against that. Armed civilians is the protection against, you know, government takeover.
Mm.
Really? Really? I don't care how organized the Ku Klux Klan or the Aryan Nation thinks they are. They cannot stand up against a committed, focused, disciplined unit of the 82nd Airborne.
I hear that.
You know,
that's very clear. And the type of weapons
really?
that they have access to, they haven't even seen. And, you know, I mean, they've seen a little bit because of the surplus of military-style weapons that have been allowed to been bought by a lot of these police departments. Look at Ferguson, look at others that have these Bearcat tanks, which were made for warfare, mm-hmm. that they've allowed to go to these municipalities that want to have this type of firepower, which is basically the quell. And if you notice, it's all pretty much the urban, those police forces that have to deal with the predominantly.
But, you know, but if a survivalist is going to seize a Bearcat, you know, and thinks he's going to use that to stand against an army. Yeah, you know, you know, a military force that is under the orders of the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to, you know, I'll see your Bearcat and raise you in Abrams A1.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. You know, I got my Abrams. Yeah. You know, I got my Abrams M1 tank. What you got?
Listen, they got.
You know,
they
I'll
got,
see
they
your
AR-15. That are basically lasers, which will melt your brain. I mean, so those guys have nothing. What they have is they're not prepared. And the Bundy activist, the guy who got killed out there in the ranch because the ranch didn't feel like paying taxes anymore, they got a little taste of that. But I want to shift the conversation and ask you guys.
Absolutely.
This attack, as the media was calling it, the worst mass shooting in the country, in the United States history. And you know, if you've been on social media, and I thought that was a little bit strange because I know of some worse mass shootings than that and people being killed. If we go back to after the Civil Rights, and not even before the Civil Rights,
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about after slavery and World War I when blacks were murdered, you have Tulsa, Oklahoma, you got Florida, 300 African Americans were killed. So the misinformation that this was the worst mass shooting in the country in history is false. Secondly, there's a lot of videos and clips about people talking about why is it when it's a Muslim or somebody of that nature, they call it terrorism. They don't call Dylann Roof. They won't call Dylann Roof a terrorist. They didn't call my man Timothy McVeigh a terrorist. And, you know, and the point of this particular subject was that when the individuals that are doing the shooting of people of other people are white, they never call them terrorists. But if they happen to be a Muslim, it's always a terrorist. And the person drew the correlation between. So what happens after a minute is that a person begins to equate Muslim with terrorist.
Precisely why the president won't use the term radical Islamic terrorist.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's precisely why he won't do it. Because of that leap, you know, because if the federal government, and this is another danger of having Donald Trump as president of the United States or someone who thinks like him, anyone who wants to use that term radical Islamic terrorist is deliberately opening a door to precisely what you're talking about, Eric, because the very next thing that happens after that is all Muslims are terrorists. That's the very next thing. That's the next place you go with that. The minute you attach this terrorism to a religion, then it becomes almost automatic that anyone who practices that religion is sympathetic to these terrorist terrorist efforts. And if they're sympathetic, then that means that then ipso facto, the terrorism, the act of terrorism, is connected directly to the religion. The religion is a terrorist philosophy. Therefore, it can be sanctioned by the government, and anyone who practices it is you know, could be charged with treason.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can close down the mosque. You can single out people who practice Islam. And you've got a situation not unlike when the Japanese were all herded into those camps.
Mm-hmm.
If it makes the Nation of Islam automatic targets, and every masjid, every mosque in the United States gets shut down. That is the slippery slope that this radical Islamic terrorism phrase represents.
Remember that the country was built on kind of a white supremacist perspective, right? Where people came over here, annihilated the indigenous people that were already here and claimed they discovered it, brought another race here to build the country, and then began on. You know, if we remember Francis Cress Wellesley's theory about how racism is attacked on those various levels, entertainment, politics, social, and then began this propaganda throughout the next several hundred years that they were heroes or the put upon people, and the Native Americans were the savages that just wanted to kill the white man for no apparent reason. The slaves.
Well, yeah, when you know that you are committing genocide, and you call yourself, devoutly religious, and you know that the scriptures, specifically and very directly speak against the idea of genocide or murder, especially murder for purposes of greed, and you're stealing land, killing people, and you're doing that, you have to have a barrier between yourself and the reality of what you're doing.
Right.
There has to be, so you create a mythology in which you become the victim, and the perpetrators of the violence are the very people you're killing and the very people that you're committing a wrong against. And, yeah, so,
I don't mean to interrupt you, Richard, but that very point is what they do now. You know, when they say the lie enough that they believe it. Donald Trump says his lie enough, and then they try to make that lie a reality. I mean, Karl Rove was one of the first ones to kind of start that. Let's repeat a lie over and over enough, and we will make that lie a reality. And it's a direct, that notion is a direct descendant of what you just said, where you're committing genocide, but we need to create this American mythology about us conquering this nation against all odds, and we're against these savages, and we have to help this other class of subhumans to be, we just had Roots come on, this new production of Roots, and also want to get everybody's opinion about what this new, how they like, whether or not you like this new version of Roots. I happen to have liked it, and I like the presentation of it. But it talked about one of the scenes was where the slave owner was raping Kizzy and was talking about, it's my wife, it's my right, you know? And it was just how they made, like you said, Richard, that mythology about, you know, it's our right to be this. It's, you know, we are the dominant race, and make up all of this crap, basically, to perpetuate their lifestyle that they tried to live and the barbaric behavior that they engaged in.
Well, yeah, you know, I see it. I mean, we all see it, very clearly in what's going on in terms of domestic and international relations right now in the present era, you know, and I commend the president for not wanting to fall into that. I even remember in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, George W. Bush took pains to say, this is not about, this is not anti-Islam. We are angry at this isn't about a war against Islam. This is a war against Al-Qaeda. He even went to the mosques, He went to a mosque in Washington, D.C., immediately to assuage any fear that people had. But you look just within months, there were people even in his administration, who were already talking about the clash of civilization. And the rhetoric isn't just, it just isn't in the West. Look specifically at how ISIS and Al-Qaeda identify the West. They call them crusaders. The crusaders. That's what they call them.
I happen to agree with you, Richard. I really feel that it's at a point where when history looks back at how this whole thing started, it was resurrected again. If anything that the United States had done during World War II and beyond that as an imperialist nation, as being a dominant world leader, that's one thing. You know, the conflicts in Africa and in Eastern Europe and places like that. But when you stop and look at what happened in 2001 under George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, because she was a part of that architectural firm to put this thing in action. You know, what's his name said, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, said that if you break this is, you own it, you know?
Yeah.
And Bush broke
Powell.
Yeah, Colin Powell.
Let me jump in here for a minute. And let me tell you how women play a role. You know, if you listen to women, they have the program of what's happening in the country down pat. Okay, and some of these people that have it and they do it in song. I'm talking about Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross, Diana Carroll, Susie Houston, Etta James, Ruth Brown, Whoopi Goldberg, what's her name? Josephine Baker, Eartha Kitt,
Joe Baker,
Nina
Simone,
Marian Anderson, Lena Horne, okay, Whitney Houston, and there is a book that you guys should find out about. And the name of the book is written by a friend of mine. Her name is Glenda Taylor. The title of her book is The Jalamuso's Drum, and she talks about all these women as having a part of, you know, seeing reality and pushing the men toward seeing reality. And she mentioned Eartha Kitt. Eartha was, you know, she was very political. Josephine Baker, she was very political. Lena Horne. So, and this is a tremendous book, Jalamuso's Drum, because of the fact that she considered these women as griots, meaning that they bring the message to the people for them to see it, and they bring it in a way of song.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent book.
But no,
anyway,
we're
running out
of
time.
I agree
here
with that book.
So, and also, I'm looking at, what do I think about Ruth? I think this rendition of Ruth was absolutely excellent. You know, it wasn't before when we first saw it. You know, we were all in shock. You know, I watched it. I had, you know, you and your sisters, Eric, everybody was around the television set when it first came out, and we watched it. And we watched it every single night that it was on. So, you know, we had the information. And this new version, great. It brings it up to present day. You know, when I say present day, it fills a gap of what happened, you know, with slavery and then how everybody fought back.
Oh, yeah, I'm coming.
So what do you guys think about that?
Oh, no, I'm actually watching the show for the first time. I had to record it because I was doing some other things and missed the initial presentations. But I think that the way that it now incorporates more of the history of what was going on inside the country during the years that Roots took place has actually deepened the show and deepened the story in ways that the first one was never able to. And it's a Roots for the 21st century. But I'm going to have to jump off the line. I have to keep another appointment that's a little family matter I have to deal with.
Okay.
I don't want to get too personal on national radio. Excuse me.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you all for having me.
We'll talk again. We'll see you at the Newark Film Festival.
And I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to seeing all of you there and all of our listeners who are in the New Jersey area. Bless you all and take good care.
Yeah, thanks for coming
Likewise.
On. And,
Thank you, Richard.
Okay. All right.
Wayne, thank you.
Thank you. I can't imagine the hour is over already.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And like Richard, I too, I'll be in touch. You know, I really wanted to come out there this afternoon, and, you know, somehow life got in the way and all that business. But to be continued, and I look forward to the festival. I remember going, when was it, last year?
Yeah, and I want you to come in. We can arrange for next week also for you to come in.
Yeah,
you know?
I'd love to be a participant, you know, in that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would like to see the Nina. I didn't get a chance to see the Nina Simone story at all. And I find that fascinating, so I'd look for
it. Go to Netflix.
Yeah.
Go to Netflix. It is so painful to watch.
Yeah, it seems like there are two different versions now based on what Eric was saying.
Yeah.
Am I right?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
No, I got the impression based on what you were saying, there are two different productions of Nina Simone.
Well, as Richard was saying, there's a documentary, and then the one I was talking about was an actual biopic, which is kind of can be fictionalized. That's the movie version.
Oh, okay, gotcha, gotcha.
Where What's-Your-Face and Zoe Saldana have their blackface on. So and we're talking about two different movies. One is the actual documentary about Nina Simone with her in it, and the movie that I guess nobody ever saw.
Also, the movie with that I saw, the documentary of Nina Simone, showed her anger. You know, she was so angry. You know, and she was angry about what she was going through and what African Americans were going through. So it was really very emotional, you know, to watch it. But Eric, you're talking about another thing, you know.
I'm talking about the feature film, which is a fictional account of it. But, I mean, we talked about that real briefly, Wayne. We had the primaries are finally over. Bernie, the D.C. primaries yesterday. So, hopefully Bernie Sanders will soon concede. He has not conceded as of yet. And,
I don't know if he's gotten the memo.
Yeah, hopefully he's conceding and he has to concede if he wants a prime time slot to speak at the convention, from what I understand from the reports by
people
that are in the know. But it should be interesting. He has some demands that he's making. Wants to get rid of Debbie Wasserman Schultz as head of the DNC. Wants to get rid of the superdelegate process. And should be interesting. Hopefully, we can get him on board. I've been tempted to wonder if his ego was beginning to get involved, because he actually won last week when Jersey and California came in, but they wanted to wait till the last primary. So the last primary is in, and Hillary is the winner. So we shall see what happens. But we have less than 2 minutes. Wayne Gilman, once again. Your expertise, your legendary newsman status. Would you like to sign off to your adoring public out there?
Oh, please. I would love my adoring public come to my rescue in a few things, but that's another matter. But always a pleasure to be on with you guys. I mean, it seems like the hour just goes by too quickly. And I know there's a demand for what it is that we're doing, and I have to commend all of you and, you know, for keeping the spirit alive. And, you know, I just think that we could just move forward, and who knows what will happen in the future here.
Yeah, that's true. And get yourself a black CPA, and you're doing all right.
Yeah, I hear that. That's another story, you know, but this guy I trusted implicitly, but, you know, not to condemn him, actually. I was thinking about putting him on just to see the back and forth, what it would be like, just to hear, because he comes out with these points, but, you know, it's just amazing. It's part of a generational thing.
All right. Got to go, Wayne. Wayne Gilman, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week. And, we'll talk to you next week. Thank you, Wayne. Once again, Blog Talk Radio, Kay Thompson Live on the blogtalkradio.com network. My name is Eric Crane.
I'm Kay Thompson. Join us next week, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. for Kay Thompson Live on Blog Talk Radio.
And you can also listen to the show archived at any time. Thanks for listening. See you again next week.